This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. So good news for our listeners. Today I was able to upload the podcast on Spotify, which is a major app for most of the Android and Apple phones. So if you guys prefer to listen to us on Spotify, it should be up in a few hours, maybe a day or so. But join us there. You can also join us at blogtalkradio.com/beatyourgenes for the live version, or you can call us to ask us any questions. So Dr. Lyle, last week we ended the show with a final question about binging on broccoli. We didn't get to it because we had our very interesting caller, Sharon, call in for a situation. So today we're going to start with binging on broccoli. You ready?
Sure.
All right. Dr. Lyle, I've got a question about binge eating and cramming. You said that no one ever binges on broccoli or carrots. Well, here I am. I eat completely unprocessed, mainly vegetables, but I still binge and cram on the healthiest of stuff. Just to give you an idea, that can be 8 pounds of broccoli in one sitting easily.
Wow.
That's also the reason I completely avoid legumes and potatoes, as they always make me overeat and, in fact, gain weight. And while my veggie binges don't necessarily mean weight gain, it is a huge burden that I have, this drive to stuff myself until it hurts. Mm-hmm. Binging on junk and high calorie foods makes so much sense and seems straightforward to overcome. Do you think the mechanisms behind my low calorie veggie binges are the same? And can it therefore be tackled with the same measures? Can you make sense of it all? Thank you for your help.
Okay, let's think about this. God, it seems like I answered something like this before, but if I didn't, I was just hallucinating. Okay, let's see now. So we have a person who is eating prodigiously, and there's a very likely reason for that. And the reason for that is that you have a diet that is unnaturally low in calorie density. So this person is—they're eating a diet that you can survive on because it's the modern world, and somebody can actually hand you pounds and pounds and pounds of this food, and you don't have to work very hard to get it. So you can survive this way, but you weren't designed to survive this way. And so one of the problems is that you've got two major mechanisms of satiation. For diverse species, including humans, and those mechanisms are chemoreceptors or nutrient reception that is going to detect the calorie density of food on the one hand, and then stretch receptors or what we might call volumetric control that's going to be on the other. So it's essentially how much are you eating, i.e. volume, and what are you eating, i.e. chemical analysis. That makes perfect sense. So if you hand a kid a pile of money, a pile of change in his Christmas stocking or in a sock for his birthday, he not only feels how much you gave him or her, but then they dump it out on the bed and then look and see how many quarters and dimes there are as opposed to nickels and pennies. And this is exactly what the nervous system does. It's looking for the calorie density of the food. Now, if it finds that there's no calorie density in the food to speak of, in other words, it's broccoli, so it's 100 calories a pound, then remember that if this is a woman needing a couple of thousand calories a day to be at equilibrium for her weight, for ideal health, she would need to eat 20 pounds of broccoli a day. So 8 pounds of broccoli at a sitting wouldn't be unreasonable at all for somebody that's eating a diet like that. So it's interesting to note that the mechanisms of satiation, which would never allow her to eat 8 pounds of cheese, will allow her to eat 8 pounds of broccoli because the detection mechanisms are working as some kind of a summed average of how much you ate and what did you eat. Now, people will, you know, since the time I was a kid, people would say, I would hear particularly, you know, beef-eating American males say, oh, boy, if I eat Chinese food for lunch, it's like an hour later, I didn't eat anything. And that's because what was happening is that they were eating, you know, they were typically eating very high-calorie-dense diets. So their stretch reception mechanisms were adapted to eating very low volumes of food, maybe 3 or 4 pounds of food a day. And now they've eaten, you know, a pound and a half of Chinese food at lunch, and there's really not that many calories in it. And so they feel full by the time they've eaten, you know, a pound or a pound and a half of food. But at the end of that, they really haven't eaten very many calories. And so as a result, you know, they're, quote, hungry a couple hours later. And they're not used to that because they were used to putting a cheeseburger in there with a chocolate shake and drowning themselves in 1,000 calories, which would last them for 5 hours. So, all right, enough of that wandering around here. So
you're making me hungry. Just kidding.
So
I do like a little Buddha bowl once in a while.
Yeah. So what we've got is a person that, an unusual individual, obviously, that has the self-discipline to exclusively eat very low calorie dense foods. And there are people that will do this. She also notes that if she starts eating potatoes, she gains weight. We're not hearing from her, and we don't know, for example, what her height and weight is. I'm concerned that this could be a borderline eating disorder type of a situation where she's very thin, or she may not be in any trouble as far as that goes, but a perfectly reasonable amount of fat for this person might be actually healthier and better off, a few pounds heavier, if she was eating a diet that had more normal calorie densities in it, i.e. potatoes, rice, beans, corn, oats, etc. Not to mention meat, which is a perfectly natural food in principle, though I don't think it's ideally healthy, but it certainly was a major component in the natural diet of human beings. And at 800 calories a pound, it's an awful long way from broccoli at 100. So I think the way I would look at this, and this is why I can't go too far, much further with advice here, and I don't want to act like I know the answer for this specific individual, other than I would probably say that the solution to the problem is to eat a diet that is higher calorie density, that is still on the low side, because this person's obviously concerned about her weight. But I don't think that you're going to have a weight problem, and I don't think you're going to be overweight if you're eating a diet that has potatoes, rice, beans, corn, etc. in it. And I think by increasing the calorie density of the food, you're going to find that the hunger drive is going to be not having you chomp down 8 pounds of food. And this is, so we essentially take the pressure off of a system that the only way it's working properly and keeping enough food in the person is to continue to eat until there's enough evidence that there's been a reasonable amount of food eaten. Meanwhile, by the time that's happening, the stretch receptors are screaming for mercy because we've gone way past the amount of food that human beings would have never normally eaten, because they never would have sat there and tried to make a diet out of food that's, you know, a couple hundred calories a pound per on average. So, you know, if this person's eating that many vegetables, the average calorie density of the diet is very low, and I'm not saying that the person's unhealthy, but we're doing a bizarre behavior, and you could continue to do it, and the system is adapting to it. There's nothing in principle wrong with stuffing yourself up to the gills, probably, with 8 pounds of broccoli. But if you don't want to do it, then let's do something else. So let's put a pound of potatoes in there first before we start eating any broccoli. And then I think we're gonna see that we're not gonna be interested in eating so much broccoli after that. If the person winds up 2-3 months later, they wind up 3 pounds heavier as a result, you know, so be it. You would have to prove to me with actual data that a person eating a diet that was balanced with respect to fruits, salads, starches, whole grains, et cetera, that individual eating, say, 6 or 7 pounds of food a day, 2 or 3 pounds of food at a sitting, et cetera, of a low calorie density diet, maybe averaging, you know, 350 calories a pound, eating 6 pounds of food a day, you would have to prove to me that diet was actually, you know, made that person overweight. I think that would be a very unusual situation, and we would look at that on a case-by-case basis. I think that what we've got here is what I affectionately call HCNCs, which are hyper-conscientious nutcases, which is we find in this arena of the dietary arena a lot. I mean, I'm acquainted with some of them. I've written a book with one.
You do a podcast with another.
Okay, so we've got hyper-conscientious nut cases, and I think that's what we've got on the other end of this question. And I would ask that this person experiment by loosening the grip a little bit on worrying, you know, and let the evidence prove to us, you know, after 90 days what would actually happen to your weight. Remember, what could happen and what hyper-conscientious nut cases that worry about their weight and eat very low-calorie dense diets often do is they're weighing themselves every day. And so when they start eating some potatoes, they step on the scale and they're up 3 pounds. And they think, see, I can't eat potatoes. But the truth of the matter is what they're doing is they're finally getting some glycogen in their liver. And so it isn't fat. You don't gain a pound of fat a day. You won't even gain a pound of fat in a week. Your human weight gain and weight loss is quite slow, typically. In other words, it may be an ounce or two a day under fairly intense circumstances. Those would be changes that would be fairly dramatic. So, but what happens is the HCNC, you know, breaks down and eats a couple of potatoes and then goes and steps on the scale and they're a pound up the next day. Why? Well, because for every pound of glycogen that you're storing in the liver, i.e., which is not fat, it's just essentially sugars that you're going to be using. It's like fuel in your gas tank in your car. So for every pound of that, you're going to add 2 pounds of water. The body's going to absorb an additional 2 pounds of water. So a person could, by starting to eat a diet with more starches in it, they could suddenly be a couple of pounds heavier typically when they weigh themselves. And they're thinking that they've gained fat and they haven't gained any fat. So this is why I would want such an individual to trust the process and wait, you know, essentially make a dietary change this direction for several weeks. And let's find out if between day 7 of this and day 70 of this, whether or not there's been actually any substantial weight gain. And if there hasn't or it's minimal, then the answer, we have found the answer, which is to move our calorie density from 200 calories a pound to 350. And in doing so, we should be able to take care of the drive to binge.
Fantastic. I always get excited when someone tells me that they can't, that they gain weight when they eat low calorie density foods, because
yeah.
It tells me that if they can violate the laws of thermodynamics, then we can actually win a Nobel Prize in physics. So I get really
right.
excited to really want to get some good data, and then, you know, still searching for that data, but, you know, I keep my fingers crossed.
Right. You got it. All right. What else do we have?
All right. So we've got a couple more questions. We've got a caller on hold.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Thanks. Lyle, how much truth is there to the view that we want what we can't have, for example, in a mate,
mm-hmm.
and that we don't really value what we already have? Does something become more desirable just from the sheer fact that it is hard or impossible to get?
No, this is an interesting misinterpretation of a correlation that people are watching. So you'll see this concept written about by various philosophers of different kinds, sort of lamenting the human condition that, some guy's got a wife somewhere and he's just not that hot on her and he really wants something else and he can't have it. And yet his wife's, perfectly good, upstanding, excellent human. And he sort of wanted her before, but now he doesn't. Now he wants something else. And everybody says, gee, what a cruel fate, that humanity faces. No, this is not a cruel fate. And here's what the truth is. The truth is that the reason why you want something is because it is subjectively more valuable to you. And the reason why it's subjectively more valuable to you is that it is in all probability objectively superior. And so in other words, you were not born with a nervous system that wants things that are not valuable. In fact, the whole concept of value is the concept of evaluation, and the concept of evaluation is one of comparison. So the entire process is comparative. And so your nervous system is designed by nature to be discerning different inputs and different sensory inputs and be observing in those different sensory inputs across all sensory domains. You're actually looking for the optimal target of your action, and you're attempting to move into circumstances that can take advantage of processes with respect to the optimal targets. That's what your nervous system, this is all fancy talk for saying that all things being equal, try to sleep with the hot person, okay? And so this is how you're designed. All things being equal, get the job that has the nicer conditions. All things being equal, get the job that pays more, okay? All things being equal, drive a fancier car, be in a fancier house, take fancier vacations, and try to be having sex with fancier people so that we can have fancier children so that they can be more competitive in getting our genes into future generations. That's how you're built. And so, of course, then, it's going to be the case that your nervous system is designed to be essentially trying to tap into the truth. And the truth is which opportunities are objectively superior for the genetic code to others. So which food has more calories, densities, which apple is sweeter. Okay, the one that is sweeter is probably the one with greater calorie density. So these things are not by any means entirely subjective. This is why the reliability data, the reliability agreement coefficients between any two observers on the attractiveness of humans is extremely high. It exceeds 0.90. In other words, it borders on perfection. It's not perfect, and we all know this is true. This is why we can disagree about who should really be Miss America and who should be Mr. Universe, etc. Now, so this is what I'm going to call the objectivity within the subjectivity. Or you could flip it around and you could say, well, there's subjectivity within the objectivity. That may be a better way of looking at it. In other words, essentially, what human beings value is objectively extremely in high agreement. That's why you don't have people running around absolutely excited out of their mind because they're going to purchase a home that the rest of the market thought was worth, the market thought it was worth $300,000, but these people thought that it was worth five times more than any other house that they saw in that range. They, as far as they were concerned, it's worth $1.5 million. And they were going to spend $1.5 million if they had it, but they look at this house, oh my God, it's only $300,000. That's not how anybody feels. Okay? People's evaluations of real estate that are easily within 5%. If you know what you're doing, you can do a drive-by appraisal on a house, and you can be within a few percent of knowing what that thing is going to sell for. Everybody that's an experienced investor knows this. So are there differences of opinion? Of course there are, but they're slight. Okay? So no non-deranged, non-high male, drunk male ever looked at a 10 female that three other men thought was a 10 and said, that's a 7. Never happened. Okay? So much less a random number like a 3 or a 4 or a 5. So the objectivity is great. So the question is there truth in this notion that we don't value what we have and we just want what we can't have? No, you value what you can't have because you don't have the chops to get it. And it's objectively superior. Okay? So that's what's going on. So now, you know, so this here lies the human condition. You're designed by nature to have yourself generating goals. And what the goals are is that they are improvements in your circumstances from where it is that they are here now. And it's going to take time and energy and competitive stress in order to achieve those goals, in order to improve your situations with respect to mates, friends, trade, etc., objective physical circumstances. And so it's going to take an investment of energy. And your brain is designed by nature to run probability assessments on how much energy is going to take to get there and what is our probability of getting there. And that multiplication will give rise to how much motivation you're likely to have. So you're going to, but even if you can see that it's a losing proposition, that it's exceedingly unlikely that you could get whatever it is that is subjectively and by definition certainly objectively valuable in the marketplace, if you can see that you're unlikely to get it, it doesn't stop you from wanting it. Okay, so you're designed with desire chips or excitement, i.e. the derivatives of evaluation that are drawing you to those stimuli in order to so that you can tell the difference between an 8 and a 6. It's exceedingly important that you can tell the difference between an 8 and a 6 so that you're in high agreement with other members of the gene pool so you don't make the tragic error of if you could have had an 8, you took a 6 instead, and now you wind up with children that are less sexually attractive and now they are than you could have had, and now your genes are going to be struggling for the rest of eternity unnecessarily. Okay? So the truth is that you want what you want because it's valuable, and you want what you can't have because it's more valuable than what it is that you could get. Now, do we not want what we can have? No. Okay? Very often you want what you have. Oftentimes you had to work very hard to get it, and it was difficult to get it, and you got it. Okay? Now, there's a lot of things that I have that I like, all kinds of stuff. I could point to them all over my house, including my cats. Now, when this person is talking about specifically about mates, is it likely that I'm not going to want what I could get? Sure, of course that's true. Why? Because what I can get are people that want to trade with me, and the people that want to trade with me are likely to be, statistically likely to be, objectively inferior to me. Now, I even hate to say that I'm objectively superior to anybody on the planet. I could just see the little quote, you know, that this is what this whack job psychologist is saying. But the point is that, of course, this is true. Okay, so it's going to be the case that everybody on Earth, there's somebody who is objectively the least valuable human being on Earth out of 7 billion. Okay, some 114-year-old individual that just no longer has any sex appeal to anybody under any circumstances. So there's going to be somebody somewhere that is the least, and then there's somebody somewhere that is the best. Okay? And you could say, well, what on earth does that mean, it's the best? Well, if we actually took the time to run the data and give everybody a bunch of photography on them, we could actually assign the objectively most sexually attractive individuals on the planet. We could do such a thing in principle. So that's a long, drawn-out answer, but what the hell. So the point is does something become more desirable because it's hard to get? No, absolutely not. It becomes, it is more desirable, and it is harder to get because it's objectively superior. That's why it is. And competitive pressures make it less likely for you to be able to obtain it. So this old saying that, gee, you know, you don't want what you can have, and you want what you can't have. And gee, you know, what a silly kind of bizarre human condition silliness that this is, and what you ought to have is just love the one you're with. Okay. Yeah, we'll take that little tune to the bank and try to have some solace in it. Good luck. Okay. The truth of the matter is, if you're very fortunate and you actually want what you have, that's terrific. Good for you. This is part of the holy grail of life, is to find such a situation. You're going to find that most of the time in the human condition, that isn't going to be the situation. The situation is going to be people are going to be scrambling under competitive pressures to try to get something that is at the upper limit of their ability to reach it with respect to its objective value. And usually they're going to get fooled and they're going to think they've got it, but they don't have it, okay, in various guises. So the guy who's superior to the female pretends like he's really into her for pair bonding, but he's not. He may actually have to self-deceive himself in order to get it. And so he's doing a number on her that he's going to hit and run. She feels at that time for the first 90 days that she has skinned the cat. She has now found the holy grail, and every love chip in her head is going off as she's got this magnificent situation. But is it in fact true? No. Okay? So now we've got the woman scorned, and feeling some, et cetera. So this is the type of thing that we're going to typically see. We're going to see an awful lot of heartbreak and frustration. And the very reason why we see a lot of heartbreak and frustration, this should help us see something that's fascinating. It's telling us how unbelievably objective mate value actually is. If mate value were not extraordinarily objective, we would not see the widespread frustration and difficulty people have in actually finding partners and getting happy with them and remaining happy with them. Okay? Yeah, hopefully people can understand this. If the standard deviation on the disagreement of individuals, in other words, the subjective values, was high, it would be very easy for people to feel like they had in other words, it would be very, very easy for two people who are a pair of sevens to think that the other one is an eight and have everybody incredibly excited. But as we can see, you can understand that if the purpose of the deal is to try to get the best possible deal at the upper reaches of your ability, then you're going to essentially see that what we're trying to do is squeeze the last nickel out of what it is that we can get out of the marketplace. And we're going to see that those tolerances or the standard deviations must be pretty narrow indeed, or else that's why we have a hard time getting this. Okay, I think I've meandered around enough and halfway answered that thing, and the answer is
no.
What I said. Okay, let's try another question. I'm just sort of looking
great.
At the wall and just talking to myself at this point.
No, it's great. I think, this question, I found it very interesting because I had a friend a couple of years ago who had just gotten into the job market, and he was mm-hmm. getting calls from recruiters, and he was telling them, oh, I'm kind of busy today. Why don't we talk, you know, such and such date? And I told him, mm-hmm. I said, we had a little disagreement over, I said, you shouldn't make yourself scarce. Like, you should make yourself appear eager to get this position, or at least talk to somebody that wants to help
mm-hmm.
you. And
mm-hmm.
his position was that, well, if I appear too scarce or if I appear too eager, then it means I don't have a lot of people after me. And
right.
So this goes beautifully into our next question, which is on
mm-hmm.
the same topic, which in self-improvement circles, people are often advised to make themselves more scarce so that people will respect and appreciate them and their time more.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Similarly, can people acting more over-rewarded or under-rewarded in relationships fool their partners with regards to mate value? And so from your previous answer, it's actually pretty much no. No.
Yeah, the answer, the baseline answer is going to be no, okay? So there's going to be exceptions to this, and there's a little bit of slop in the system, as you can imagine. And that slop is specifically going to be taking place very, very early when people are trying to sort of figure out where things seem to be at. Now, no guy that tried to act cool to some girl who wasn't hot on him, you know, is going to be able to trick her for very long or pique much interest. This is all this every guy that's having a hard time getting what he wants to hear the secret from the pickup artist. And the great secret is act cool like you don't care, because then what happens is that she then infers that she's actually, you know, that you've had better, and therefore she's not so fancy relative to your expectations, so therefore she must be misreading her own nervous system that feels like you're beneath her, and suddenly she will recalibrate as a result of you being cool, and then she'll bite.
Like a miracle.
That strategy. Good luck, okay? Now, I'm not saying that never worked on some girl that was, you know, two or three sheets to the wind. You know, maybe so, okay? But it's a terrible strategy in general. It's not going to fly. This is assuming people don't have an independent method, i.e. their own eyeballs, to look and see what they think about how attractive somebody is. I thought about this. This is kind of interesting. Now, suppose that I'm a young, professional of some kind, and I have like one client a week, and somebody calls me and says, "Gee, you know, could I get an appointment on, you know, could I get an appointment?" And you say, "Certainly." And they say, "Well, when could I get an appointment?" Here's a good thing not to say.
Right now.
Really? Anytime you want. I don't have a single thing on the books. Okay? That's probably not a good strategy. So we are going to do a little bit of bluffing here, and we're going to try to, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to infer that we have some reasonable trade constraints, because there are, in fact, other people after us. So we might say, "Well, what day would be best for you?" And they say, "Well, Thursday." "Well, that's good. Actually, I've got a couple of times on Thursday." So this is an example of the deep example is what I call the fish trick. Okay, so this is, you know, I've talked about this in previous podcasts, but this is the story of imitation throughout nature. In the fish trick, I don't remember the name of the fish, and somebody can email it to me, but some tropical fish off the coast of Madagascar, I think it was. I think it's Tasmania. There's a tropical fish where the male has an orange amount of material on his body on the side. And it turns out that females find the male that have the most of that orange sort of stripe to be the most attractive. And so what investigators did, this was in the late 1990s, it was published in Scientific American. It's a really interesting study, and I've seen other versions of this since, but this is the one that I remember. Is that there was a three different level, or three different guppies, or whatever these things that are, that they used. One of them had 18% orange on his side, the other one had 27, I think, and the other one had about 42. So this was sort of, you know, short, medium, tall, or skinny, medium, built, or whatever you want to call it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is, and so what they did was they presented these males in pairs to females, but the females were observing older females of the species who had a choice between these pairs. For example, between the 18 and the 27, the older females chose the 18. And so what they then did was release the young females into the cage after this, and the young females went for the guy that was 18 instead of 27. This is very interesting. And then they did the same thing between 27 and 42, and the young females went for the 27. And then they went 18 against 42 so that it looked like the older females went for the 18 and the young females went for the 42. So they were able to establish that there are limits to the imitative function. In other words, you can have a bunch of beautiful models clamoring all over Danny DeVito, but the real one that isn't being paid to do so, that walks in the joint, ain't interested. Okay, so the question is, what is the degree of the ability of human beings to be lured by what other members of the species are doing? And the answer is a little bit. Okay, a little bit. And so it's not a lot. It's not, this is what I call the fish trick. And so the fish trick is going on in commerce. So if you say, you know, I've only got two appointments available on Thursday, this is the fish trick. Okay, the fish trick is other people are buying my services, and therefore you should, i.e. this is the concept of demonstrating that you must be valuable or you wouldn't have any degree of scarcity at all, okay? There are very pretty severe limits on this. As I said, it, in something like this where people don't know you, haven't traded with you, and don't have an ability to evaluate your ability versus others, then this is going to be the most powerful position and utility of the fish trick. If it's some girl in a bar that you're trying to hit on, good luck to you. So go ahead and pay the hot hooker to come up and kiss you on the cheek. See how that works out for you. my guess is the girl in the bar you're interested in has a pair of eyes, and she has a Stone Age brain, and she has mating search images in her head. And I don't think, no matter who it is that gives you a kiss on the cheek, is going to make much difference about what it is that she thinks. All right. Fair enough.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we've got two more questions on marijuana usage and spousal abuse, but we're going to keep those for next week. And we're going to welcome our caller who's been on hold here.
Very good.
Stephanie, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Very good. Where are you calling from, Stephanie?
Utah.
Oh, Utah. Is it freezing cold?
It's very cold.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, tell us the story. What's going on? What are we working on, and what are we trying to get better?
Okay. Well, there's a lot of pieces involved, so I'm going to try to condense it as much as I can.
Okay.
I'm not too long-winded here. But it's overall about setting boundaries with family. My husband and I, we lost our daughter, our first daughter, a couple years ago.
Wow.
And began a whole journey of a grief journey for me, for both of us, but especially for me on a number of levels. And we always had really good relationships with our families beforehand, but as time was passing, there were more pregnancies and more babies in the families, and it just became really difficult for me to be around family, go to family events. And so I kind of had to stop, pull myself back and stepped out a little bit. My husband would still go to some things with his family, but I just kept getting this feeling I just need to get out of here. I need to get out. Because most of our family, we both have large families. Most of them are in Utah as well. And so there are always events happening, always things are being invited to or feeling obligated to go to. And I just kept feeling like I need to get out. And finally we up and left. We actually went to Europe for a couple of months. And when we were there, I just felt so liberated and so free and just so, so good and happy. And then we came back to Utah and things started to be progressively more difficult. And so we kind of cycled about three times where we would come back to Utah, things would get really difficult, and I would just I need to get out, and then we'd leave, and then we'd come back, and we'd leave, and then we'd come back. But this time my husband actually landed a job here in Utah, and so we're here to stay. And I just felt when we were away, I finally had the space and the ability to have all those relationships that were hovering in my mind just be lifted, and to feel like I could explore more of us, explore more of who we were as a couple and where we're trying to go as we're navigating this through this grief journey. And as we had time and space to ourselves outside of family, we realized that we were really diverging a lot from our tribe, our family norms, whether religiously, how we ate, we went, and even politically or how we wanted to do healthcare or anything, a lot of ways that we knew would be disapproving by our families and could even be really heartbreaking for them. And so we kind of kept a lot of things sheltered or away from them.
Right, quiet.
Because, yeah, exactly. And so not that we're living secrets, but we kind of felt like
yeah.
we had to be really intentional with the things that we were saying and how we were doing things, and
mm-hmm.
which makes it obviously difficult to have really meaningful and fully open relationships with your family. So they become
mm-hmm.
a little bit more surface level, and when you don't feel like you can be seen for who you are and be supported
mm-hmm.
and accepted. And anyway, and so we've been married for almost 10 years now. And in a lot of ways, I still feel very parented by my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, they've even sat me down. They pulled me aside and like, we need to talk about something, you know, or just like, I'm concerned for you in this regard. And I'm kind of feeling like that's no longer your role anymore. Like, you're not my parent. Like,
mm-hmm.
but anyway, I don't really feel like we're seen as our own unit as the two
mm-hmm.
of us.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really understand boundaries, whether it's like the religious culture here or just the Utah culture. To them, it's like we're a happy family. We all love being together, and we expected that everyone's here for Christmas and so I just feel like we're in this really big transitional state of through grief and our lifestyle and religion, and I finally end up being pregnant again. So I am currently 6 months pregnant, and neither of our families actually know yet. And
mm-hmm.
I've been able to keep it to ourselves. And so what's been difficult, I was worried coming back to Utah of how I was going to approach this new pregnancy, and if I was like emotionally ready to tell them and how much I wanted them involved. And my husband is very much a people pleaser. And so I know that when we spend time with his family, he's wanting to help. He's wanting to be involved, or he wants to maintain some of those relationships. But for me, it becomes really difficult. And sometimes I wonder if he's appeasing them, if it's he'd be like, oh, I just need to go so they don't think blah, 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 or if it's actually, like, fulfilling for him. And because at one point he once told me, like, you know what, I'm done. I'm done with my family. Let's just be us. And when he said that, like, it was, like, a big relief, and I just felt so, so excited. I'm like, yes, this is what I've been wanting. I've been wanting us to be able to be our own unit. I want us to be able to define who we are and figure out how we want to live and not be limited by these family relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I can't push in there, and that I just I don't feel like I can expect him to give up his family relationships, because I just know that I need some space. I need to be able to feel like I can, understand. And as I mentioned, we're in such a transitional place where I don't really know exactly where we are, and there's nothing definitive. We're trying to figure it out. But I feel like I don't have the mental capacity to even deal with any of family relationships before I can just get settled back here and, trying to navigate all of these emotions. And, the problem is with this new baby coming up, I just know, like, I know I need some sort of boundaries. I know something needs to change, because it's really hard for me to be here and so close to family and constantly being invited and obligated and feeling like I can't really fully be who I am. And but I don't know, because I still do find some value in one-on-one relationships, but at the same time, I still feel inhibited. But with this new baby coming, my initial feeling is that I don't really want very much involvement from family, but
mm-hmm.
at the same time, not having any living children, I have no idea how much support I'm going to need.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And feeling a little like I want to be able to tell my family, we're not going to be here for the holidays. We're not going to spend it with you. We're going to spend it alone, because I just can't go through another cycle of horrible holidays. And I don't want you involved in our life right now, but if I do need you and baby comes, then maybe I'll call you. But otherwise, you know, like, I don't want to like try to abuse any sort of relationship of like, I don't need you, but I'll let you know if I actually do. But and so I just, all I know is that like when we left the country. We were out of state. I've never felt so liberated and so happy and felt so good. But I'm still trying to figure out what exactly those boundaries. I don't know if having no contact or if maybe having some phone contact or some one-on-one, or if it needs and how that affects like my relationship with my husband and how, where I can expect him to be or, anyway, that's
okay.
Where I am.
Well, here's a few, I got all kinds of ideas about this. And so, we'll sort of run around the chessboard here because there's a lot of different things to consider. And there's a lot of details that, that I won't be able to know. So I'm just going to try to give you some ideas. I think the richest set of ideas that I can point you towards is Harry Brown's book, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. I think that for you and your life, as for many people, this is just an extraordinary document that will point you towards a way of looking at relationships that's somewhat, I think it will clarify for you a little many life strategies that that might be useful. He's a little too honest for my taste. I'm much more willing to be deceptive than he is. But the notion of being true to yourself and figuring out what it is that you want and living your life the way you want to live it, that's what we're coming to do. Now, your husband and you are not the same person, and so you each have your own lives. Now, those lives intersect, but you're two independent, unique points of consciousness, and so what's optimal for him is not the same thing that's optimal for you. There's horse trading and negotiation and compromises that need to be reasonably done. I would say that in principle that you, like for example, don't have to have 1% more interaction with your in-laws than you want, okay? Or your own family for that matter. And neither does he. Now, the fact that he may make life easier for him if he's able to parade you into his family situation, and i.e. your better daughter-in-law, et cetera, that's something that you guys need to talk through about whether or not that needs to be horse-traded. I would, myself personally, it's pretty hard to drag me into anything just because I'm an introvert by nature anyway. I don't suffer fools well at all, and it's torture for me to spend 2 or 3 hours with, in some social situation with a bunch of people that I'm expected to be something that I'm not, and I'm not happy about being there. So that's, it's not immature, selfish, or it is selfish. It's basically, I want to do it the way I want to do it. And so I completely understand where you're coming from. That doesn't mean that we don't get a feel from your husband how tortured this would make him, what would be reasonable compromises, how much overlap would be reasonable, et cetera. But in general, my strategy would be to say that we should be spending as little time as possible on any social situation that we don't like. Okay? That's like very minimal. Obviously, you're already thinking through that, family is possible. Family, pleasant family, are insurance policies. You're thinking that you might need some insurance if you need a bunch of help with a kid. Okay, then now you're opening up yourself to a trade. My general strategy with respect to these kinds of things, I have a phrase that describes it, which is called pay market prices. Because when we start trading in insurance policy, i.e. familial and friendship relationships, with people we're not wild about trading with in order to save market prices on things, then we wind up with these contracts that we don't really like with essentially, debts that we don't want to have to pay. So be careful there about that notion. and make sure that you can afford to be without these people and their insurance in case of needs of, you know, family help with kid, a new child, et cetera, et cetera. So think that through and make sure that you can afford to pay market prices. Because if you can't afford to pay market prices, then it's like too bad for you. Okay, so you get clear about what it is that you may need and understand what those market prices are, and we're not going to try to chisel some, you know, not very well-loved relative into ponying up a bunch of time and interest in a faux exchange where we don't really want to make the exchange of friendship and family connection and love because we don't feel it. Okay? So we want to in principle, have a clear understanding about what's in our best interest, and then we act from that position after we've communicated this with our partner and really get it clear. Now, another lesson in life is that we want to follow, you know, our feelings are clues. They're trying to tell us things. And I heard you explaining that when you were out of Dodge, life was a lot better. And mm-hmm. It wasn't the scenery, okay? It's what wasn't in the scenery, i.e. this passel of relatives, all right? So as a result, we can tell that you feel the social pressure to be somebody you're not, interact in ways that indicate that you value these interactions in a way that you don't. That this is, you know, it grinds on your teeth. And you got out of Dodge and suddenly all that's gone in the relationship between you and your husband, you know, the feelings that you have in life improve a lot. In other words, we don't have any problem with him. We've got a problem with all these relatives, right? So my point is also keep in mind, you're not a tree. So who was it? Your husband got the job in Utah?
Yeah.
Okay. Good job?
Yeah, it's a really good opportunity for him.
Good. Really good opportunity for him. What kind of work does he do?
Computer science.
Is this the only computer science job in the United States?
Absolutely not.
No, it's not. So here's another lesson in life. You're not a tree.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't really care how good of an opportunity it is. I've heard that there are opportunities in other places in the United States. So if you need to be there for a while because this is the best opportunity on the chessboard and you're having a child that's coming and he's got health insurance and you can afford everything and it's a good salary and you can save some money and pay off student loan debt, blah, blah, okay? Don't mm-hmm. care. In that case, my attitude is, great, this is a place to park for a while and we're going to have some, you know, difficult little problems with relatives that we're going to have to negotiate. But my attitude would be, this is time limited, okay? Because from what you're telling me, you know, in the old West, they'd say, this town isn't big enough for the two of us, okay? And from what I'm hearing, that's where you feel. That's how you feel. And you feel a lot better by having geography solve the problem of what I call the disagreeable distance. So, you know, your life gets better if the relatives are 1,000 miles away. That massively reduces the hurt feelings associated with the fact that you're not integrated with their lives very much. They would want a much greater integration. You don't want that integration, okay? And so you don't want to hurt their feelings. You just don't want to be that integrated. So the most elegant way to do this is to not be living within 1,000 miles of these people. Completely reasonable strategy. If your husband was, you know, I don't know, some guy that was in an apprentice to somebody that has a fancy key shop and they only do those keys in Utah and this is the only opportunity that he's ever going to have, then I would say, bummer. Oops. Okay, we're going to have to figure out how to institute boundaries on the disagreeable distance as elegantly as possible, and we're going to have to just choke down life because who is the guy? Who is Scrooge's helper? Bob Cratchit? Well, you know, whatever it is, like, hey, if that's your husband and that's the situation, and you got a bunch of mouths to feed and no other abilities, you got to choke down Scrooge. But if you're not, you're not a tree. And you ought to be looking over the horizon and realizing, I don't care how good this opportunity is, this is temporary and we are getting out of here as soon as it's practical. Okay? I think that's a discussion that needs to happen. And from the sound of how it is that you feel about being surrounded, then I feel like, you know, you got to be aiming at that escape. That's great. And there's no reason you shouldn't. If we're confident, we've run the experiments enough to know you've got enough insight into your own psychology. You've got all of your phenomenological existence can run all the numbers on who it is that you like, who you don't like, in what way, and this is not a set of circumstances you want to be in. Okay, so now for the present, when it comes to instituting boundaries, there'd be all kinds of strategies. You know, we've got wish I could, but I can't. We don't communicate. We communicate pleasantly, very pleasantly, but rejectingly by email. We're real busy, et cetera, et cetera. We just shuck and jive and dodge as much as possible between now and the time when the moving van's coming. But that's what I'd be aiming at. Does that this make some sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it does.
What questions?
I guess part of what weighs on me, though, is like having those invitations come in the first place, or even if I've gotten to a point where I would say I just can't come to any of his family.
Oh, okay, are you still there? Oop.
Oh, it looks like Stephanie's call got dropped, so we can just kind of talk until she calls back. It looks like she just had a cell phone problem or something. So we'll just wait until she calls back.
Okay. Actually, no, I would continue just with this thought, probably for her, she can listen to this later, which is that we're as pleasant as possible. We can still do a lot of rejecting. And the people on the other side can be a little bit miffed and a little bit disappointed and a little bit frustrated and put a little bit of pressure on the husband and other social pressure, but that's okay. It's like everybody can just be a little bit stressed, a little bit strained, a little bit rejected, but not blatantly rejected, and no fights and no harsh words or anything else. We're just kind of, just aren't quite understanding that we should be getting with the program, but we seem all friendly about it, but the answer keeps being no.
Stephanie's back.
This is how we do it, okay? And we just use that strategy to duck out of everything. And once in a while, four times in the next year, we relent and actually show our face a few things for an hour and a half. And we smile at everybody and kiss them on the cheek. And, you know, here's our baby or whatnot. And then we're out of there. And we're aiming at a nice civilized place to live somewhere else. Does that make some sense?
Yeah, no,
this
it does.
Let me say one more thing. I have a little technique that when I have to face something that I really don't want to do, I have what's called the mathematization of misery. And that's that if you've got to, if there's something that you're going to have to do, it's nice to know that it's really time limited. So let's suppose you had, between, in the next 12 months, let's suppose we had to choke down a dozen family events. And those dozen family events, the best we could get away with would be 4 hours, okay? So it's like, okay, we got 12 times 4 is 48 hours. So we have a little business card in our pocket from some realtor. And on the back, we draw, 12 little boxes or 48 little boxes, 24 little boxes, 2 hours each. And while we're there, we got our special little grid, and 2 hours goes by, and we get to check a box, okay? And we keep this with us. And the next time we go, next month, we check another box. So pretty soon it's exciting to go because at the end we're going to be checking some boxes. And we're going to get to see that, it's not too much longer that I'm going to have all these boxes checked and I'm out of here. So this is a way to to reward oneself and to have a nice reminder that this is time limited and we can put up with a lot of crap, okay? A lot of people across the history of the world have done an awful lot of suffering and had to endure a lot of difficult things. We can endure for 48 hours in the next year. You can endure your relatives if that's a reasonable minimum that will keep people right below the level of acute frustration with you so that we don't have to have any big drama, okay? Keep it right there and then get out of Dodge at the first, quote, good opportunity. Make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And my husband is also looking forward to be able to get away and seeing this as kind of a springboard job.
Yes.
And we just want to, I guess, do you think it's better to try to be dodging these things and risk them avoiding, like accusing us of avoiding them? Or is it better to just kind of sit down and be really upfront and just say, we're figuring ourselves out right now. We kind of need a little bit of space.
Yeah, I think you could send a group email, or I don't know what the structure is here, but you could say, listen, you know, we really appreciate the invitations and the warmth of the family, just wonderful people, blah, 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 blah. How fabulous. We flood the circuit a little bit. However, it's going to turn out that right now we're going through some, you know, we're going through a lot of things. This is where you land the pregnancy on them. Okay.
Yeah.
Say, listen, you know, we're, you know, for a lot of reasons, as you can understand, given our situation, you know, we're expecting a child. I don't really want to be talking about it. I don't want to be processing this with the family. You know, this is our own private journey here, and it's difficult, and it's fraught with a great deal of anxiety. Okay. So please don't reach out. Okay. Because we kind of want to walk this road quietly on our own. We've got a great deal to do in preparation and a lot of management here to handle. So we greatly appreciate the family support and the warmth and the connectedness here. But for these next few months, we're going to need to, you know, from your standpoint particularly, you're going to need to, you know, we're going to need to be bowing, you know, away from some of these family things that are just a warm and terrific, you know, testimony to the fine people that are in it. Okay? Flatter,
yeah,
flatter,
that's
flatter,
great.
Flatter. No, no, no. Okay?
Well, thank
Does that
you.
Make
thank
sense?
You so much. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. Very good call, Stephanie. Thanks very much.
Yep, thanks.
You bet.
All right, Stephanie.
All right.
Thank you very much for hanging on there. Dr. Lyle, again, thank you so much for going overtime again.
Absolutely.
Twice in two shows. I like it.
Oh, terrific. All right, Dave, thanks for everything, and we'll see you real soon.
Very good. Talk to everyone next time. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.